Broadcasting worldwide on internet radio.
Refreshing takes on legal strategies.
Straightforward answers to difficult tax questions.
Independent ideas on building wealth. The Refresher Wealth Show with Mark Kohler and Matt Sorensen.
Previously recorded with Mark as the host of The Mark Kohler Show.
Enjoy this fresh take on strategies to better live the American dream.
Everybody, to today's show. My name is Mark Kohler, your host. Excited to be here with you on a beautiful February, I guess, lunchtime for many of you. I know many of you listen to this via podcast, so welcome for all of you that are late at night, catching up on email, listening to the show, running on your treadmill. Glad to have you. Thank you so much for listening in. This is a show about building wealth, saving taxes, protecting our assets. I'm a CPA, attorney, author, family man, partner in two incredible teams in our law firm and accounting firm, serving clients nationwide, helping people, again, build wealth and save taxes along the way. Love that. Love saving money. Little Benjamin Franklin, a penny saved is a penny earned. So that's what this show's about. Welcome all you new listeners here. Please spread the good word. We're here every Tuesday at 11 a.m. Pacific, 2 Eastern, rocking your world. And today, at a show that will certainly do us justice. I'm excited about it. We've got a very unique show, a show I've never had before, where we specifically focus on trailer parks and mobile homes. I know that sounds a little outside the norm, but it is growing and growing as an important segment of the real estate investing industry. There's been experts out here for years, you know, trying to yell from the rooftops that this is an area that people need to think about when they're investing in real estate. And there is a lot of profit to be made in mobile home and trailer park investing. So we've got some experts here joining us later in the show, a panel, if you will, of several folks that are going to share what they know about the topic in our brief time together today, and hopefully give you another option in your investment pool and your portfolio of investing. And I'm really excited about this topic. So I'll quit saying much more about it until we tackle that closer to the bottom of the hour. But as usual, we first start with some tax and legal tips, something that can help all of us in our strategies to better live our American dream. So I'd like to lead today's blog articles and newsletter that goes out nationwide every Tuesday morning at midnight. Frankly, it goes out 3 a.m. Eastern, 12 Pacific. I stay up late every night. Every Monday night, fine-tuning this newsletter. It's got some important tax deadlines. We've got just everybody starting to turn in their tax data. Many of you are already compiling your information and send it off to your accountants. It's tax season. We're in full throttle, so it's cranking. So please know that if you need any support with that, give our office a call. We'd love to work with you. And if you've already been with us for years, your PTC, your personal tax consultant, is waiting to hear from you. 1099 forms that you issued in January, you can still get those out. You still can get them out. I know a lot of people think, oh, Mark, I didn't get my 1099s out, so I'm just going to bag it. It's just not worth it. I'm scared I'm going to have penalties and this and that. So what do I do? And do I just give up on it? Don't. You can still fix the situation and a lot of times you're not even going to get tagged by the IRS on this topic unless you let it go longer and longer. So if you haven't issued 1099s to your vendors for last year, there's a couple good blog articles at markjkohler.com. You can link through it through the law firm and accounting firm. Check that out. Find out what your responsibilities are. Call our office for some help there. It's very simple and cheap and easy to get it out. But if you don't, the penalties can add up. The 1099s you issued, to my main point here, is you have to send in paper copies to the IRS by the end of the month. So you were to issue them to your vendors by the end of January. Now you've got to issue your copies of that triplicate form to the IRS by the end of February. If you digitally submit your 1099s, you have till the end of March. So just keep it in the back of your mind. Don't totally put that off. If you think you missed the deadline and you're just going to put your head in the sand, don't. Get those 1099s out the door. So that's point number one. A couple interesting other points here on the newsletter I think many of you will find. My weekly message, I wanted to talk about your charitable service that you might perform for folks and charitable time you spend, money that you contribute to charities. It's a tricky topic, and so I went through some ideas and options of making sure that you capture those charitable things you did last year. This is a great time of year to submit any receipts, copies of checks. Think back to the miles you may have driven, service you performed last year, and have a plan for this year to maybe get a better write-off. And I kind of joke here at the end of this little message that, bottom line, oftentimes the emotional and spiritual rewards of serving in a charity outweigh the tax benefits, but the tax write-off doesn't hurt either. So check it out. I think you need to maybe read that little article there and get up. I have an article I published today titled Finding Good Tenants, An Attorney's Perspective, and I go through six different ways to find a better tenant and protect yourself from a bad situation. A lot of good rentals can turn into a bad deal quickly if you have the wrong tenant. So check out that article. I think you might like it. And we've got a great article, Matt Sorensen, that I think he might be talking about on his tip today. So I don't want to steal his thunder, so we'll come to him in a moment. But if you're not getting the weekly newsletter and blog with the tax deadlines, I usually submit a little video in the newsletter so that we get a little video action there, kind of split it up a little bit. I've got a video titled The Big Mistake You Should Avoid with Your First Tax Return as an Entrepreneur. So this is your year where you bust it out, and this is your first tax reporting period as an entrepreneur. Check out that video. You'll like it, too. Hosted by entrepreneur.com. So let's go over to one of our tipsters here at the first of the hour, one of our regular routines. We're excited to have him here with us today. It is already tax season, so it's a pressure cooker over there. But we've got Brian Brown with us. He is a CPA. He's joined our firm, 7 to 8 years ago. He merged his firm from California. He's a very, very seasoned CPA and business planner. We're grateful to have him a part of the team. And we're going to see if he's had a good tip this week that he experienced to share with us. So, Brian, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks, Mark. It's good to be on again. It's been a couple weeks, but it's good to be on again.
Did you like how I used the word seasoned CPA rather than old fart?
Well, you know, every time you use it, pretty much every time I come on, you use the word seasoned. And everybody knows it means old. I mean, come on, let's be honest here. And you know what? Doesn't bother me. You know, if you go onto the website and, you know, the Kohler & Nair website, and there's a picture of me on there, yeah, I'm old. I've got gray. You know, what can I say?
Look great.
That's okay.
Well, old means experienced to me, because many of you you'd probably be pleased to hear. One of the first phone calls I made this morning when I was in my car was to Brian, asking for some advice and tips on some technical issues, and he's a wealth of information. So we're so grateful to have you part of our team. So, Brian, what do you got for us this week? Anything good?
Well, it's interesting you mentioned 1099s, Mark, because I've got a thought on it, and I'm trying to save people a bunch of heartburn when I make this comment.
Okay.
I have seen a lot, and when I say a lot, I mean a lot of issues where people have paid subcontractors or individuals, businesses, whatever the case may be, and it's time to do the 1099s. And we say, okay, I need their name, address, social security number, or case of a partnership, their employer identification number, and they say, I don't have it. And I said, well, I need it. We need the 1099 to get the 1099s out. So they've called the people, and guess what? They won't give it to them.
Funny, that's
yeah,
weird.
Yeah, and so the point being, and it's been this way for quite a few years, before you pay anybody, especially a subcontractor, or, you know, anybody that you're going to potentially give a 1099 to, get a W-9. That form is available on IRS.gov, a W-9. It requests all their information, and you literally should have that W-9 in your hands before you give anybody a check. Because
I love it.
That gives you the information. It's going to save a lot of heartburn. It really is. Because even as you attempt, you try, you do all the things, and they don't want to give you that number, you're kind of up a creek.
Yeah, and I think this is so good you're bringing this up at the beginning of the year, too. A lot of you folks that are listening may have tried to issue 1099s last month, trying to follow the rules, making sure you avoid a penalty, and then your vendors gave you a runaround, and it wasted a lot of your time in January. So I think this is great, Brian, that you're bringing this up, that this year we could all have a better New Year's resolution, that when you have a vendor that you're going to be paying for services, make sure that you get a W-9. And they may tell you, well, I'm a corporation. You don't need to 1099 me. Great. Fill out the freaking W-9 so I can put it in my file, and I know that. So don't let anybody say, well, you don't need to do it. You know, get it over here.
Yeah, get like you say, even if they say the corporation, then there's you know what? On the W-9, there's a box that says corporation. They can mark it. You know, but like you say, when or if you get audited, and you've got that W-9, and you've got that thing that's signed by them, and it says they're a corporation, even if they might not be, you're not the one who's in trouble. They are. You know, the vendor is. And so, again, let's just kind of get all our ducks in a row, so to speak, and get rid of the heartburn and the stress so that we can make this easy.
Okay. I like it. Great.
You know, when we're doing when we're doing W-2s, when you have an employee, you make sure you get all the information on the employee. You know, let's make sure we get all the information on the vendors.
Yeah, I love it. Well, great comments. Pretty simplistic point, but again, folks, time is money, and if you don't have to track down your vendors next January, it'll save you a lot of heartache. So just have a file. Scan them. It could be even a scanned little file. Take a picture of the 1099, the W-9, and put it in a little W-9 folder so that at the end of the year you've got them all in one spot. You send it over to us. We crank out the 1099s. It's easy schmeasy. That's a technical term in the tax world. Easy schmeasy. We shoot for that. Brian, thanks so much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Hey, you're welcome, Mark.
All right. Thanks, folks. Yeah, thanks. Well, Brian Brown, if you need to get a hold of him, you can reach him by simply an email even, Brian, B-R-I-A-N, at ke-cpas.com. That's K as in Kohler, E as in Air, -cpas.com, ke-cpas.com. Thanks, Brian. Okay, well, we're going to run over to our legal tip. We have a regular contributor and sometimes guest host of the show, my good friend and partner on the law firm side running our Phoenix office. We have Matt Sorensen with us. Matt Sorensen, who just released his new book this month titled The Self-Directed IRA Handbook. And this book is fantastic. He's sold hundreds, I'm sure over 1,000 copies already just in the first month. I think I bought 50 to 100 books, and I'm already out. And Matt, I need you to come visit me here and bring me some more books. How are you doing?
Good. Well, I'm going to be in Southern California. I'll be in San Diego on Thursday speaking, I will be bringing books.
Hey, why don't you throw that out? Tell us where you're going to be Thursday night for anybody in the area. And some of you some of the folks in the Midwest and East Coast, they're enjoying the weather. They just drinking hot chocolate and coffee, and they're just nice and enjoying that kind of that winter. Maybe they don't need to get out and come to San Diego for a few days. But if they did, if they wanted to get out of the snow, where would they go?
All right, well, I'm going to be in San Diego, and I am looking it up right now. it's Thursday night. It's the San Diego Investors Club, and
I think it's at the Del Mar Marriott. Is Del Mar Marriott or Del Mar Hilton? One of the two.
Yeah,
Del Mar,
I was going to say Hilton. I was going to say Hilton. I'll have it here in a second to confirm, but I will be there on Thursday night. Email me if you're like, give me the direct specifics, but yeah, I'll be there talking about self-directed IRAs and real estate, how you can partner and stuff like that.
Well, you know, and I just want to mention this for everybody that's maybe not too familiar with the topic, and this is going to play right into mobile homes and trailer parks today. Why aren't we buying more mobile homes in our IRAs, huh? And you can do that, right, Matt?
Heck yeah, yeah, you can. Why not?
Yeah, I love it. And the nice thing about Matt's presentations is that he's really taken it to the next level. This book is packed. 250 pages worth of detail. This is not a fluffy presentation. He talks about how you can put in your own money with your IRA in an LLC and buy a mobile home. There you go. So why not partner with your IRA? And don't listen to any crackpot out there that says you can't be the manager of your LLC either, and that you don't have liability if you do it directly out of your IRA. There's a lot of misinformation out there. So Matt will be unveiling the secrets Thursday night.
That's right. I'll be giving you the truth.
There you go. All right. Little expose. I watch the news. I watch, you know, TMZ. I know what's going on. I follow Justin Bieber. Yeah.
Hey, you know what's up. You know what's up.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, speaking of what's in the news, you know, I was gonna try and bring it full circle here and combine the phenomenon in the news and the President's State of the Union speech last week with retirement accounts. As many of you know, President Obama in his State of the Union decided to create a new retirement account called a MIRA, which is supposedly a way to help people save for retirement. I'll kind of explain the details here, but kind of interesting. It's being created by executive order. The president's just taking this upon himself and creating this plan, and I think there's very few benefits to it, but I'll explain it because it's certainly been getting a lot of buzz in the news.
Yeah, and I want to clarify, this is a MIRA, not a Miley, to confuse yourself with Miley Cyrus and twerking. This is a MIRA. So kind of a unique name there. So
yeah, if yeah.
I
Google
with your
the wrong
association,
thing here.
Don't Google the wrong thing here. You might have some office politic issues. Okay, so how's this? Let me ask you this. Why did President Obama, to be respectful here, why did President Obama introduce this MIRA? What was so? Why did he need to do this?
Well, you know, what they look at is those who have a 401k at work are 9 times more likely to contribute to their retirement than those who work with an employer that does not offer a retirement plan. And while those who are working for an employer could always go set up an IRA, whatever bank, credit union, wherever they wanted to, a lot of people don't, and they really feel like the power of having the money come out of payroll, which is how 401ks are funded, you know, it comes right off your check, you don't even see it, and it goes right into the account, that power is significant. And so what the goal was is to try and figure out a way of how can we get workers in small business where there's not a 401k or other employer-type plan offered to start saving directly off their paycheck. And this is this is what they came up with, this MIRA account.
Well, what do you think? Is it going to work? Is it going to help people save more?
It's going to. Let me kind of go over the rules here. So, first of all, this is voluntary. Thank goodness, you know, for small business, this is voluntary. So, if your employer wants to allow workers to save in this way, they can volunteer into this program. And they'll take payroll deductions, and essentially you're going to be sending them to the Treasury or some department or third party that will privately run this. You know, the Treasury has been tasked to create all the rulemaking on this and figure out how it's going to actually work. The policy, you know, obviously coming from the president. But so this will happen, you know, in your business, small business, or, you know, if you're a worker at a small business, the money comes off at payroll and it goes to the Treasury and is invested into a Treasury security. There's no choices. You can't say I want to invest it in Google or I want to buy stock in, you know, XYZ company. Or there's one investment choice. It's a Treasury security. And everyone who puts in through a MIRA will be invested in that same Treasury security. Now, there's supposed to be no fees. So, you know, I guess it's going to be funded by the government, all the administration of this. So there's supposed to be no fees. And the way it works is they are treated like Roth IRA dollars. You do not get a tax deduction for the money you put in there, but it grows tax-free and the money comes out tax-free. But therein lies all the contradictions in what we've already heard from the statements. The president talked about, you know, people taking money out of their MIRA account as if they had a hardship or some emergency, whereas Treasury Secretary Liu talked about people pulling money out of these MIRA accounts just like a Roth IRA contribution, where, for those of you that don't know, you can pull out Roth IRA contributions whenever you want. So it's there's some differences here in the rules on how this works, that just in the interpretation between the president and the Treasury Secretary, they're a little inconsistent. But the basic point is you can save a little bit. If your employer adopts it, it goes into a Treasury security. It's treated like a Roth IRA. You can roll it out to a Roth IRA. But the problem I see with this is twofold. One is you don't get to pick what you invest in. So you're in a Treasury security. Pretty much think of this
but hold
more
on,
like money.
Investing in the U.S., that's a great deal. I mean,
yeah,
it's
a great deal if you like 2% returns. So,
yeah.
And you know, I will say they have been pretty good about calling this a savings account and not referring to it as an investment account. So don't really think that you're going to be making, you know, this is not typically an investment where you're expecting investment returns. This is really just a savings account. And, you know, at least they're calling it what it is. So it's basically a savings retirement account. But the other problem with it is it's limited to $15,000. So once you have $15,000 in this account, then you're forced out of the MIRA program. But at that point, you can roll over to a Roth IRA where presumably you'll have more investment options, you know, depending on where you roll it to, whether you self-direct it or whether you just go to a bank and buy mutual funds or whatever's, you know, offered to you.
It sounds like President Obama is trying to do anything he can that doesn't involve Congress's approval, and this is one little area he could screw around with and try to do something.
So there's not a lot of love up there, I guess. So, but I mean, I think this will help some people. I think the problem is you know, and this is my big gripe with it is rather than increase contribution limits on existing accounts that are out there and trying to work with Congress so people can really put enough away for retirement, you know, they've just created another program that's going to basically help people get $15,000. Well, I mean, you can't even retire a few months on $15,000. I mean, how far are you going to get in retirement on that? So, I mean, it's really just basically a starter account. And you know, we'll see how it goes. But the president did have actually a program I did like, automatic enrollment IRAs, in his budget last year, in his budget proposal, and he's still in favor of that. That's been proposed now in the Senate by Senator Tom Harkin, where it's called automatic enrollment IRAs, where you can automatically enroll with your employer if they don't offer another plan, and money goes directly into an IRA. But there, you could be able to pick whatever you want, and it's subject to normal IRA rules, but you're not stuck investing into the government securities, which is basically what your Social Security money is already going to anyways.
Okay. Well, Matt, for fear of someone, you know, falling asleep at the wheel and careening off the road, either out of boredom or frustration, and that's no offense to you. You're having to report on a very tough topic. we're going to move on. But, you know, this is a really helpful article. Matt, you write about this in your blog today. And so I think, folks, if you want the 411 on this MIRA strategy, I'm not a fan. Also, whenever you can't self-direct it and invest in what you know best, that freaks me out. But that's my take. And I don't know. The government's trying to help us save. Anybody saving anything is probably not a bad thing. So,
yeah,
Mr. Matt Sorensen.
So.
Yeah. Well, appreciate you coming on the show. Appreciate it.
All right. Thanks, Mark.
We'll see. Oh, did you confirm the location there for San Diego's event? Did you find that? Just so we have the exact hotel?
I did not, but if you want to go, just email me and I'll get you the details. You probably do need to register anyways in advance, so just email me and I can get you the details if you are interested. It's Matt, M-A-T, at kkoslawyers.com.
Okay, that's Matt, M-A-T, one T, and K-K-O-S is in Sorensen, kkoslawyers.com. So send Matt a quick note if you want to catch up to him. It's an investment club, I mean a real estate investment club, so the cost is very nominal to go to these things. We've talked about that topic on the show before. Yeah, $20. So come out and see the master, pick up a copy of his book. Matt, thanks so much.
All right, thanks, Mark.
All right. Well, okay. Well, I'm so excited. It's perfect timing to once again introduce the topic for our show today. Welcome to many of you that joined us through these first few minutes of the show. My name is Mark Kohler, your host today, and you're listening to The Mark Kohler Show, and we're going to be talking about investing in trailer parks, mobile homes, and the hidden profits and strategies that this little cottage industry has just blown up around the country. There are so many killer strategies in this area of real estate investing. And using your self-directed IRA is a real common strategy we're seeing more and more. So that's just an underlying theme. We're not going to focus on that today. Just know you can do it. And I'm really excited to introduce my panel of guests today. So first, let me introduce Nathan Rossi and Christy Duckett-Harris. Nathan has come to, I've come to know Nathan through Fortune Builders, Inc. 500 magazine, top educational company around the country. Many of you have heard of Fortune Builders. He's been one of their head advisors for years. And he's also a licensed mobile home broker in the state of Florida. He's educated thousands of students in 22 states on the topic of real estate, financial education, and mobile home park investing. He owns several businesses, currently investing in mobile homes himself, and his partner, Christy, right there by his side, is a full-time real estate investor herself, investing in real estate around the country, speaking around the country, and I'm just so excited to have them with me. Welcome, Nathan and Christy.
Hey, Mark, how are you?
Good. Hey, excited that you could. Hello. You're not experiencing any snow or bad weather down in Florida. Your flights aren't being canceled. You're okay down there?
You know what? I was out at the pool yesterday, and blue skies, all was well. We're about 80 degrees, and no complaints here.
Oh, my gosh. You're stabbing a dagger into the hearts of many of our listeners up north. So no more of that talk. No more. This is a family-friendly show. Okay. Well, let me also introduce our other guest here. So excited to have him here with us. This is Frank Rolfe. He's been in the manufactured home community owner for two decades, currently ranks as part of the 17th largest community owner in the United States with over 9,000 lots in 17 states in the Great Plains and Midwest. He's the author, co-author of the book Mobile Home Park 10-20, that's 10/20 investment system, the only proven way to make big money in mobile home parks. And we are so excited to have him here with us as well on the show. Frank, welcome.
Hey, how are you doing? Nice to be here, Mark.
Good. Well, thank you. Now, where are you calling in from, Frank? I didn't catch that. I apologize.
Well, I'm not as fortunate as the other panelists. I'm in southern Missouri, and we're in a roughly a blizzard right now.
Wow.
So it's pretty bad out the window here, but we're hanging in there.
Well, I hate to say, my wife hates this. I am a very nostalgic winter weather guy. I love to snow ski. I was a snow ski instructor in college, and you could pluck me into a blizzard 3 or 4 months out of the year, and I'd be happy camper. So I'm with you, Frank. I'm enjoying it. That's the time of the year.
Sure.
It's January. We should be getting that, you know, February.
That's right.
Okay, you guys have heard my little introduction there, of course. I'm so grateful you're here with us today. I've got listeners all over the country that will be listening to this show repeatedly for months to come, if not years. This is a really big topic. And but let me start with you, Nathan and Christy, and just ask, why are more people not investing in mobile homes and trailer parks? I mean, what's the big misnomer out there that just people should know that they're missing?
Well, Mark, I mean, let's face it here. I mean, for the person who doesn't really know about mobile homes, mobile home communities, the whole manufactured housing industry, what's your first thought when you think of a quote-unquote trailer or a trailer park? It's not often a positive one, is it? I mean, has that been your experience, Mark?
No, I would say I think of something that's going to depreciate. I think of something that's going to fall apart. I get nervous. I don't know. I just don't think of it as a quality long-term investment. Now, I'm just telling you my initial reaction. I think a lot of people probably feel that way.
Well, and Mark, being the author and the savvy investor and businessman that you are, if you're feeling that, imagine what the normal, you know, beginning investors are thinking as well. That stigma is there. And what we've experienced just as we've really grown our company and our brand is that most people either have that just a really negative stigma of just misunderstandings about trailer parks, about mobile home communities and the industry as a whole. But also there's just a lack of education. I had an investor about 2 weeks ago who said, you know, I understand that I can make over 30% on my money, but what would stop one of my tenants from just pulling his Chevy up and you know, pulling the trailer away? And, you know, just that right there is just, to me, hear stuff like that all the time, and I'm sure Christy could attest to this as well, is that there's just an ignorance, and I don't mean that in a derogatory manner, but there's just a lack of knowledge and understanding of what is really there. What would you say, Christy?
Absolutely.
Well, Christy, let me ask you. I mean, here's the real question, Christy. Is Duck Dynasty helping your cause or not?
I think it's helping our cause for sure. I think the problem that happens with investors is they've been taught that mobile homes are depreciating assets. They don't really look at them as the cash cow that they are and what the return on investment can be. So they just kind of shut them out of their mind and go on to the single family.
No, that's a great point. In fact, I talk to many clients that would rather invest in a meth lab than a mobile home. And I'm like, what? I mean, there's got to be a problem. Frank, what's one of the most surprising things students you have a mobile home university where you teach students. What's one of the things that kind of shocks people that when you start to talk about mobile home investing that people didn't realize?
Well, I think one of the key items is the very fact that they call these things mobile homes could not be farther from the truth. As he just described a second ago, I mean, they're anything but mobile. It costs about $5,000 to move one from point A to point B. So basically, I think the national average is something like 95 to 98% of all mobile homes never leave the spot where it's originally delivered from the factory. So I think that's something most people are confused. They think that mobile homes are just like RVs, where you hook it up to your nearest pickup truck or SUV, and that's not the case. It requires a licensed mover. It's a big deal to move one. So the fact they can't move the homes means basically your tenant base is static. Your revenues are hugely consistent. You can raise rents as much as you want. No one can leave. So that's probably the first thing, mainly because the very name mobile home implies you can just quickly move the home.
Yeah. No, great point. And now, As I know, Frank and Nathan, Christy, all three of them had told me, Mark, you could talk about this all day long, and we'd still have issues that we need to uncover and talk about. It's really a very complex topic, but exciting. So I know it's going to be tough in our short time here together. But Frank, if someone does want to start looking at mobile homes, what should they be looking for or not looking for? I know the first part of your book, you go through the due diligence and all that. Where do people start?
Okay, well, as far as the kind of park you want to buy, you're going to want to buy a park that has traditionally city water, city sewer, no master metered gas or electric. So there's certain infrastructure issues that make a park desirable or not. Locationally, you want to be in an area that's got good diversity of employers, Not a one-horse town scenario. You might want to be careful if you're looking at buying parks that are coastal with the impact of hurricanes and such. As far as where you find the parks, Mobile Home Park Store would be number one. LoopNet would be number two. Those are the two online sources for parks. Thereafter, a lot of the brokers, which you can identify off of Mobile Home Park Store and or LoopNet, that deal in mobile home parks, they typically have a lot of pocket listings. And those are some of the best deals you can find out there. And then beyond that, now, people do direct mail, cold calling, all kinds of different stuff.
Now, Nathan, do you guys see investors hold parks in a combination, a more obviously more expensive investment, or do you still have investors just buying onesie-twosies and buying mobile homes themselves?
You know, that's a great question, Mark. And our focus really for where we are in Central Florida, located in Tampa, you know, we have opportunities cross our plate every day for parks. And one of the things that we've seen on the community level is an influx of a lot of these private equity firms, big hedge funds, partnerships that are coming in and really, you know, they're just buying up a lot of parks. So there's a in Florida anyway, there's a significant amount of competition there. Well, the niche that we've really developed is offering turnkey mobile home portfolios for our investors. So these are anywhere from 5 units to 10, 15, 20 units that could be in a single park or spread over 2 or 3 different parks. And what we're finding is that there's nobody that's really doing it on a turnkey level. There's some mom-and-pop people out there that are doing it, but there's nobody that's really systematically approached this niche. And they're really phenomenal investments. For the average investor that doesn't know about raising capital to get into a park, doesn't know the first thing about running a park, you know, these are great investments to get into at under $10,000 a unit. And to be able to cash flow the same as you would a single-family home, 30 to 40% return on your money. I mean, this is where we're finding a lot of the beginning and even intermediate investors that are not only coming out of the financial markets, pulling their money from traditional 401ks and things of that manner, but even real estate investors, people who, you know, have gone to flip properties and do things or try to wholesale properties. It's got so competitive that they're now looking and saying, where can I park my money? I have 30, 20, 30, 40,000. Can I park that into mobile homes? And they can, you know, they, for $30, $40,000, they can pick up 4 or 5 mobile homes and be cash flowing at 30% plus. And so that's really who we're gearing toward. We see a big demand in that.
Okay. Now, Frank, is that, Do you really have two groups of students that you're educating, too, those that want to buy a larger park? Do they buy mobile homes as well, or are these folks that are just buying mobile homes or a different type of investor? Is there really a difference?
Well, yeah, there is. I mean, we deal strictly in the mobile home parks themselves, not in the homes. I mean, there's certainly an industry there in that. We don't deal in that. But, you know, the park site itself can be, you know, based on the size of the park you're buying, fairly capital intensive. And there are a lot of folks out there who start off doing the homes and then kind of building up equity in the homes to then buy a park. We see that fairly commonly.
Now, do you see park owners, and this is one of the reasons why I love this diversity of you guys here today. I know that both of you focus on different parts of this industry, and I really appreciate your both of your perspectives. Frank, do people that buy parks, do they also buy the mobile homes that are in those parks? Or once you buy a park, you're looking for investors like Nathan and Christy to bring people in and populate the park with homes? How does that work?
Sure. Well, you know, every park is different. I mean, we have a park, for example, in Charleston, South Carolina, that we don't own a single home in the park, and it's full, and probably may never own a home in that park. And then we have a park we bought in Dallas-Fort Worth that, you know, we own, or the park came with about 240 rentals that we are now in the process of renovating and renting out. So, you know, every park has its own personality. Some are home intensive, some are not. Often we'll buy a park that's got vacancy and we are definitely looking for folks to bring homes in or we're doing it ourselves. I mean, you can't really be in the park business and not also to some degree be in the home business. It's
okay,
impossible.
Can you What would the average, I mean, Nathan was referring to the cost of a mobile home, maybe ranging from $10,000 to $20,000. I want to come back to that, Christy, as well, in the cash flow that you were talking about earlier. But, Frank, staying with the parks for a minute, I don't even know this. What does an average park sell for? 100 pads, or you call them pads, or do you, what, right?
Well, typically lots. You call them pads or lots or units.
Okay.
The you know, there is no typical. There's 50,000 mobile home parks in the U.S., and they range in size from 2 units, which is the smallest you can be to be a park, up to well over 1,000 units. But let's just say probably the average in the U.S. on a park is maybe 50 lots, and probably the average sales price of a park of 50 lots, if you average the whole U.S. together, that's California, Florida, New York, and then states such as Mississippi where they're really cheap. Probably, you know, it's probably running $10,000 to $15,000 a pad. So a typical park is probably $500,000 to $1 million. It's pretty much the norm.
Okay. Now,
many that are much smaller, much less expensive.
Okay. Now, and I want to come back to your 10-20 system of how you analyze these parks. But Christy, back to the investor that's buying homes rather than the park. Could you give us a little better, give us some numbers on the cash flow side too? What would the average mobile home cost, and what is this cash flow that you're talking about?
Absolutely. And, you know, depending, Nathan talked about, we usually buy a lot of those homes in people's parks. So obviously, let's take, for example, you buy a home for around $10,000 to $12,000. You're renting it for $600 a month. Well, then you actually have to go ahead and pay out lot rent to the owner of the park. So everything past that point is cash flow. So let's say the lot rents are $200 a month. You're renting the unit for $400 a month, and that's cash flow into your pocket. Obviously, taxes would come out of that maintenance. But that's the great part that brought me really to mobile homes is the taxes are very low on mobile homes compared to single-family homes. So you can cash flow a lot more profit per month. But really, you're probably bringing anywhere from $350 to $400 per unit. For such a small investment.
And you said a lot of your investors are buying them in bundles. They may buy 5 or 10 homes in one park. Who do they use for property management? They're not probably using the park manager. They're probably someone separate from that. What do you do for property management in a situation like that?
A little of both. It really depends on the park and the situation. Sometimes they have on-site property management, and then with a lot of the bundle packages that we are giving the opportunity for investors to buy, we'll actually property manage those on the back end. So if there's a property management fee, depending on how many homes they purchase, it would be anywhere from 8 to 10%. And looking at that, you know, I kind of give the typical example of if you buy a single family home, and let's just say on the lower end of $50,000, or you can buy 5 mobile homes for, you know, 10 grand a pop, and you look at really your return on investment. If you're making $350 on 5 of those homes, look at your cash flow on that versus a single-family home that's going to rent for $700, maybe $750 a month. And the return on investment is very strong in the mobile homes.
Yeah, but here's the question, though. Is a mobile home going to hold its value? I mean, I'm sure Frank could tell us how a trailer park is going to hold its value or appreciate because of the land itself. But I wonder about that. I mean, guys, is a mobile home, I mean, with a stick build, and I buy it for 50 grand, I know it's going to still be worth 50 grand or more. Even if it's a meth lab, it's going to hold its value generally. But how are mobile homes doing on that?
Well, I would say, I'll chime in on this. You know, I would say that although that's a great question, I think that the issue is not really appreciation or depreciation. I think the real issue is just going back to cash flow because, you know, in real estate, you can force appreciation in a property by highest and best use methods. You can greenhab, you can rehab, you can do all these things to force appreciation and get that big payout at the end. But realistically, in the end, you know, mobile home investing, especially on the per home unit and unit side, it's really about cash flow. And so in the end, there's people, it's a matter of perspective. It's about people that are looking and saying, I would love to own something. I can't own a home, but I would love to own a manufactured home. And I'm willing to pay $6,000, $8,000, $10,000, $15,000. I can put that on a 3 to 5 year note. And they're willing and happy to pay for that, because it's a sense of, it's their small slice of the American dream. It's their small slice of home ownership, in a sense, and they're willing to do that and willing to pay that because, again, it's affordable housing. That's the big thing with mobile homes. It's affordable housing.
Oh, excellent. Now, folks, we're talking about mobile home parks, trailer parks, investing in mobile homes, which is very different than a trailer park itself. If you have a question for us today, you can email me, Mark, M-A-R-K, at markjkohler.com, or give us a call at 646-200-4285. Lisa Owens is in the studio. She'll bring you out. And we do have a live caller now with a question for Frank about mobile home parks and some of the changes they're going through. Gary, welcome to the show.
Hey, guys. How are you doing? Mark, how are you doing? Matt, how are you doing, if you're still on the line? Appreciate the show. Just have a question. Here in Utah, there are a number of trailer home parks, or I've experienced with clients, friends, that it seems as though the owners of the parks or the pad, or whom they tend to have leases instead of ownership of the pads, are kind of pulling the rug from under these clients, these long-term clients. They're not renewing leases, and they're going for more traditional, long-term, single-family homes and the sort. What's your experience with that, those type of transactions, or for the investing in the long term?
Thank you. Okay, Frank, what are your thoughts on that?
Okay, well, you do see that trend in areas where single family prices have gotten super high. For example, there was a mobile home park bought in the Los Angeles area. It's the highest price ever paid for a park. It was about $60 million for about 200 pads, and the park was purchased with the idea of redeveloping it basically into kind of a gated community, taking the same mobile home park sized lots but putting new manufactured homes on them that are two-story or single-story with attached garage, and then those sell for, you know, I think the plan is anywhere from $200,000 to $400,000. You're not going to see that phenomenon in most parts of America because the home prices just aren't there. I mean, you have to have very, very high single family to make someone want to buy a mobile home for, you know, $200,000 or even $100,000. But you will see more of that in any area where you have, you know, sky-high single family. I mean, most of the areas where we own our parks, the median home price is about $100,000 to $150,000. So our stuff will not be ripe for that concept for decades, if ever. But you are going to see more of that. I mean, there are some pretty amazing properties. For example, you know, the most valuable mobile home park in the U.S. would be Point Doom in Malibu. Pam Anderson lived there fairly recently. Sean Penn has lived there. Mobile homes there sell up to $2 million. And the lot rent is roughly $2,000 a month. And that property, I'm sure many people think, would be much better utilized to be torn down and made into beach houses that start at $5 and $10 million, which they may do at some point. But that's a very tiny microcosm of the industry. But it's an interesting point.
Gary, thanks for the call.
You're welcome.
Frank, on that note, too, if you're investing in trailer parks, that's not a bad upside, too. If you're going to go out and buy a trailer park, you might see that as an exit strategy down the road anyway, wouldn't you?
Yeah, you know, one big advantage mobile home parks have, and the reason you see a lot of mobile home parks redeveloped into these things that, you know, people have been trying to get but could never get, is that typically most cities want to get rid of the park if they can. So if you own a mobile home park, you can typically get it rezoned to almost any use you want, because anything you do, the city thinks is a plus over the park. So, for example, I had a mobile home park in Springfield, Missouri. They built a Walmart down the street. Next thing you know, I had people coming to me wanting to buy the park for redevelopment. And what we found was we were able to rezone the back half of the park into a multifamily zoning so dense it had never been allowed before. Tried many times, always failed. They sent out the notices to everyone within 500 feet of the property, and people loved the idea. Anything to get rid of the park was was a great concept. So it passed unanimously. So that's why, for example, you'll see in an area where typically nobody else can get the Lowe's. For example, this happened in Oklahoma City a few years ago, right? Lowe's wanted to go in, residential area. Everyone fought it. We don't want a Lowe's next to our houses. They went, bought the mobile home park, and, of course, everyone said, oh, thank God, get rid of the park. You know, we like Lowe's more than the park. So, yes, you do have that one little leg up on everybody else.
Well, and talking about this exit strategy, Nathan and Christy, that's something you're probably really concerned about, or when you're looking for mobile home portfolios, you want to make sure you're in a park that's not going to pull the rug out from under you. Or what are your concerns when you're looking for the perfect park for one of your investors?
That's a great question. One of the things that we do before we purchase any units, before we offer any of our homes to investors, we have a very extensive five-step due diligence process, and one of those gets very, very in-depth into the local community, the ordinances, planning, looking at what's happening with the urban development, statistics, all kinds of things. And so we do cover those bases before we make any significant purchase within an area to understand those things. But, for sure, that is one of the, you could say, one of the downsides, just purchasing the units. I guess the rebuttal to that would be that, in fact, although statistically most homes aren't moved, there still is that possibility and that availability to actually move the homes and relocate them to another park. So you always have that option sort of as a last resort, if you will. But for sure, that's how we would deal with it in Florida. What about you, Christy?
Christy, can I ask you this? Christy, can I ask you this question? So if you were saying, and this leads right into that, I loved what Nathan was saying there, is if you were talking about maybe a 25 to 30% cash on cash return on one of these $10,000 to $12,000 mobile homes, which is phenomenal. In reality, 4 years from now, you've got your money back, and anything above that is gravy, right?
You took the words right out of my mouth, Mark. Exactly what I was going to say. And it was funny because you had asked Nathan earlier about the depreciation of mobile homes and all that, and that's exactly it. You pretty much made your return back in 2 years. So anything above it is gravy. You have a lot of people in different areas that say, oh, my gosh, what if a tornado comes and blows through and takes all the houses out? And it's like, well, you pretty much made your money back in no time, so it's a great investment. But absolutely. Yeah. We do have to do our due diligence on anything we buy. And I tell everyone, worst case scenario, you buy a park, you make money for 10 years, they come in, they redevelop, and you sell that park and make the money on the land. So the win-win.
Yeah, and so I think you made an important point. If I own a trailer, should I buy tornado insurance?
We talk a lot about insurance, and to be honest with you, here's the thing. There's liability, I tell anyone, in any investments that you make, but you can take out insurance, and especially if you're renting the properties you want to because of tenants and other things. But the reality is, I guess, depending on how much you put into the homes and how long you've had them, you really have to weigh that out and look at your return on investment, if that makes sense.
Well, and I must have a twisted sense of humor as a CPA, but I was trying to make a joke out of that. I would presume if I was in the trailer, I would definitely want tornado insurance. Maybe some of my regular listeners caught my twisted humor there. Real quick, I want to go back to Frank here. In our last 5 or 6 minutes here, I want to give us a time for our guests to give their contact information out. But Frank, I'd be remiss if I didn't give you just a minute here to mention this 10-20 system. What is this concept all about? Is we've got listeners here that want to make a wise decision on a trailer park. What recommendation would you give?
Okay, well, Dave and I wrote that book as just an initial intro to the industry and kind of how it works, because many people, as was mentioned earlier, don't understand the industry or have a horrible bias against it for no worthwhile reason. Basically, when you buy parks, you're trying to buy them at a 10% cap rate, and you want to buy them with upside to grow that cap rate up. The goal is often 20%. Some parks can't get to 20 just based structurally on where they begin life on their rents, but most of them can get up into the mid to high teens. And then basically what you do at that point is you then either keep the cash flow or you resell the park and do it all over again. And so really the range we see of park returns is roughly 10% cap, which if you have financing will get you nearly a 20% cash on cash day one. Then you hold it, grow it, groom it, and you can often drive that cash on cash. We have some parks right now that do cash on cash up to 100% plus. So it's all over the map. But that gives to people who are unfamiliar with it an idea of what the returns are, because they're so much higher than any other use. I mean, apartment, office, retail, single family, nothing can touch mobile home parks. I mean, they have been the highest returning niche of real estate now for decades. So that's why I wrote the book, just educate folks.
I love it. And Frank, we had a question from one of our listeners via email from Pam. She says, what do you consider the average amount of single pad rent? This can affect your cash flow as a homeowner. Of course, you're going to want to see the highest rent as a trailer park owner versus the investor with owning the home itself is going to have a different perspective. But what do you see the average single pad rent? Nationwide,
I can tell you that
regionally.
Nationally, the lowest you'll find is in the Deep South, Mississippi, Louisiana. There are rents there as low as $85 a month. Often includes water, sewer. It's insanely low. Highest in the U.S. are in basically California, some parts of New York, Florida. The rents can get up to $2,000 a month, like the park in Malibu. The national average for all parks is running around $250 per month. So that's kind of the average in the U.S. It's about $250.
Well, I'll tell you, I'd rent a pad right next to Sean Penn and go out and ask for a cup of sugar for $2,000 a month. So,
there you go.
I'd be cool with that. Well, Frank, how do people get a hold of you? What's your book's on Amazon. You're out there on the web. But where would you like to send folks that are listening that might be interested
sure.
in having you help them?
You know, the best way to reach me is directly on my email. It's frank.rolfe, R-O-L-F-E, at gmail, gmail.com. So it's basically my name, frank.rolfe at gmail.com.
Okay. Well, thank you, Frank, and we appreciate you being here with us today.
Sure.
Wealth
Thanks
of information. Oh, there's so much. Stay with us here for a moment more. But Nate and Christy, please tell us how folks can get a hold of you, and if they're out there as a new investor looking to get in the market with just even a few mobile homes, this could be a great start for someone, even in their IRA again.
Yeah, sure. I love that you guys brought that out earlier, and. Would love to even talk about that more, IRA investing. But essentially, they can go to our website, metropolitanhousinggroup.com, or send me an email personally at Nathan, N-A-T-H-A-N, at metropolitanhousinggroup.com. Christy?
Yep, and you can actually check out our other website at southcarolinacashflow.com and go directly through there.
I'd like that. It's got a little more of a ring to it, even SouthCarolinaCashflow.com. And, folks, on my newsletter next week, I'll be, again, leaving links to both Frank's information and Nathan's and Christie's on our newsletter next week so that you can follow up with them directly if you choose to do so. And, Nathan and Christy, thank you so much for finding some time to be with us as well. This is just a fantastic topic. Any final words that you'd like to share?
You know, thank you, Mark, for having us on and sort of, giving some voice and opportunity here for a great industry and some great investment opportunities. And we look forward to the future.
Absolutely. Thanks, Mark.
Well, thank you. And, Frank, any final word from you here?
Well, just I think everybody owes it to themselves as an investor to learn more about the mobile home park business. High rates of return, steady cash flows. I mean, it's a great business. Been in it 20 years back when no one liked it or cared about it. So it's fun to see people suddenly realizing how good a business it is.
Well, a great suggestion. I think I'm going to be looking at it more closely. And I've got clients. I just had a meeting with a client last week talking about a trailer park up in the Northwest. And I was excited for the call. And so good stuff. Frank, thank you too again.
You bet. Thank you very much.
Oh, I cut him off on accident there. I apologize for that. Well, everybody, thank you, the listener that makes this all possible, for being here on the show. And please spread the good word. Let people know that we're here trying to provide a voice of reason, common sense, and honesty in investing. And hope to see you next week on another episode of The Mark Kohler Show at 11 a.m. Pacific. And again trying to help us all live that American dream. God bless you. Amen.
Thanks for listening to another hour of refreshing strategies to better live your American dream.
Don't forget to get your free copy of Mark and Matt's ebooks and sign up for their weekly free newsletter with important tax deadlines and articles at refreshyourwealth.com.